the basic issues. Well, I guess in some ways they can be very simply stated. Everybody wants to live long, but nobody wants to grow old. And I guess for a modern addition, we would add that medicine has added years to our lives, but has not added necessarily life to our years. I'd like tonight to say a few words about the overall field, and then to limit myself in the formal presentation to the traditional Jewish approach to some of these problems. That's my field of expertise, obviously. And I'd like to leave some time at the end for some questions and discussion, so that we can have a better idea of the problems that face all of us and form some of the future sessions around those ideas. Age is a new frontier, a new problem. Now, the statement sounds surprising because we're accustomed to thinking of age and aging as having been part of the human experience for at least as long as there's been recorded history. And this is particularly true if we think of our own religious tradition. The Bible speaks of long life. We have the Jewish hope, you know, Ad me'ah ve'esrim, b'shodu nesfansik, you should live to be 120, which was the symmetrical number of years, which added up to three complete generations, the number of years of Moses' life. The Bible contains a number of references to people like Methuselah, who lived inordinately long, if the biblical chronology is to be accepted. I think Methuselah has the record 969 years, according to the myth in Genesis. But I'd like to suggest to you that the problem is new in the sense that ours is the first or second generation in which there have been a sizable number of aging and aged in the population, and in which aging and aged, the aged have not been limited to the upper classes. If you look back in recorded history, you'll discover that only the rich really lived long. They are the only people who could afford the supports that permit long life. They were the only group who became guaranteed nutrition, family supports. They were the only group which was not brutalized and ultimately brought to a premature grave by the severity and the cruelty of the work which they had to do. Now, there were exceptions, obviously. But the existence of a sizable percentage of the population over 65 or over some age which we determine to be the age at which we describe aging as beginning or having intruded in our lives is a relatively new phenomenon. Let me give you some figures. In 1900, one in 25 in the American population was 65 years of age or older. By 1970, one in 10 in the American population was 65 years of age or older. And the demographers tell us that by 1980, which is not so far from now, the figure will be 1 in 6. 18% of our population by 1980 will be 65 years of age or older. And the growth is much larger, of course, than the growth of any other part of the population. In 1900, from 1900 to 1970, the population under the age of 65 grew 2.5 times, and the population over the age of 65 grew 6.5 times. So we face a new number, a new problem, both in fact, in terms of the range of the population, and in terms of the quantitative size of the problem which is before us. Now, of course, most of this is the product of the miracles, the triumphs of modern medicine. But unfortunately, medicine is a limited field. It solves the problems which afflict our physical frame, illness, from the it keeps us from dying prematurely, but it cannot solve the economic, the social, the emotional, the family problems which are concomitant with age, which are inevitable. A number of very serious problems have emerged. The first is that this is the first time in the world, really, that the adult population, that is the adult working population, has had to provide financially not only for the children, but for the aged. Up till now, historically, it was the upper classes, those who could most afford it, who had the aged. The aged controlled a good proportion of the wealth of a society, and so the fiscal burden was not as sharp as it is now. But today, and if you only have to look at Social Security in the United States to recognize the pressures exerted on the social budget and on family budgets as the working population tries to pay, on the one hand, for the high cost of education, and on the other hand, for the high cost of institutionalization. These are tremendous costs to be put against the laboring man or woman. The second problem that we face is that up till the last two generations, perhaps the last three generations, it's been assumed throughout history that the aged and the aging were the problems of the family. The family was equipped to take care of the human problems of aging. It provided the financial support if such were needed, and the society as a whole did not accept the responsibility, was not assumed to have to accept the responsibility for the aging. This tremendous increase in the numbers of the aged and of the aging has come precisely at the time when the family itself is most embattled. The extended family gave way to the nuclear family. The nuclear family itself is giving way to what we're not quite sure. The mobile family has emerged, which means that it is not at all unlikely that the aged will be in one community and their children will be in another community. Or the aged will be in one community and only one of the siblings will be in the parents' home community, with all kinds of pressures of time and service and attention resting upon only one small part of the family. Now, as the society has had to take up the slack, we've obviously had to exchange the family as the place in which aging takes place for institutions. And we have inherited any number of prejudices against institutions. Many of those who were raised in another era believe that when children allow their parents to be put into some kind of support institution, they are somehow defaulting on their duty, showing indifference to the real needs of the parents. And many parents balk against going to institutions for that reason. And in point of fact, many children feel guilty when a parent or parents have to be institutionalized. And short of institutionalization, the society must provide a whole number of supports for those whose free time is now full time, and they must provide all manner of encouragement, of developmental opportunities, and we simply are not yet geared up. We haven't really thought through the problem of what to do and how to do it to help care for those who are not yet ready for institutionalization and perhaps may never be. Another problem which faces us as we confront this problem of aging is the problem of the health of the aged population. 4 out of 5 people above the age of 65 suffer from at least one chronic disease. The demands made by this cohort of people who are in the aging population on our medical services is enormous. When someone over 65 goes in the hospital, their average stay will be 3 times the average stay of anyone under the age of 65. Now, the aged, of course, are precisely at that period of time when their incomes are limited, Medical services are precisely that part of the population where the costs have increased most astronomically. There's a whole aged population out there that is almost beyond the reach, cannot reach out to adequate medical services. We're not sure what medical services ought to be provided, how these ought to be provided. There's a whole ambit of problems here which need to be faced. And finally, it's surprising how little we know about this new problem. Compare with me for a moment what our attitudes and what we know about childhood to what we know about age. We know that there are various periods to childhood: infancy, the child, puberty, the adolescent. The Gazelle Institute and Dr. Spock and all of their successors taught us to recognize the different patterns in the 2-year-old, the 2.5-year-old, and the 5-year-old, and the 7-year-old. We have all manner of tests to evaluate their emotional development, their physical development, their intellectual development. We have child psychologists and child psychiatrists. We have day schools and nursery schools and pre-nursery schools and Head Start schools and all manner of schools. And we know to the day whether a child should go into kindergarten or he should not be held back for the year or pushed ahead half a year. The degree of sophistication which we bring to our children is remarkable. The degree of ignorance which we bring to the process of aging is equally remarkable. Oh, we know that there's some kind of difference between senescence and senility, between those who need certain supports and those who really can no longer manage adequately in the open society. But we don't know the stages of aging. We don't really know very much about why certain people age much faster than other people. No one has really worked out systematically the stages of aging. There's some preliminary studies, but they're very preliminary. And the problem is that we're at the stage where we tend to treat age as if it's a simple problem, a single problem. We have no other word to speak of, really. We call the age you're aging. There you have it. But clearly the man of 70 who is capable of going downtown to his office and working a full day, competing quite easily with a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old, is not the same person as a 70-year-old man who's had to withdraw from his work and whose energy levels are low and whose memory is failing. Yet they're both 70, and they're both going through a process called aging. Obviously, we need to learn a great deal more. And obviously, we've got to confront some social and some welfare problems, some financial problems, some questions of human relationships of immense proportion. And we're only making a beginning. When we tried to put together the bibliography which you received tonight, all of us were startled by the paucity of material which was available to us, that is, to an intelligent, concerned public, having to do with this problem of age and aging. There's a great deal of goodwill, there's a great deal of concern, but we're only beginning to develop the basic research. And obviously, given this situation, most of us, all of us, I'm sure, are caught up in a series of assumptions which we learned from our parents, which we picked up from the conditioning of our childhood about aging, about independence, about dependence, about the responsibilities of children, about the responsibilities of parents. And we may be very wrong in these assumptions. We may be right. But the point is, we really don't know as yet. What we do know is that all of us are going to have to cultivate a new attitude towards aging. The aged are going to have to cease thinking of themselves as in retirement, as having pulled away from life, as being over the hill, and therefore useless to themselves and to others. And the young are going to have to cease thinking of the aged as dependent upon them, as growing burdens, as people whom it is best for the society to put out to pasture because they have nothing constructive, innovative, creative, you know, those terrible words of the youth culture, to contribute to the society. Now that's the range of the problem, as I see it. It's a problem which is going to call for a massive investment of time, of personnel, of attention, of money, proportion of the national budget. It's a problem which is going to force all of us to rethink our attitudes towards ourselves and towards our own development. Because if I am convinced from my reading of anything, it is of this simple truth, that age is not simply a state that you happen upon one day when you hit 65, but like every other stage of life, it is an opportunity which you must prepare for, study for, equip yourself for, with the same diligence and the same amount of determination and discipline that you applied when you were 16 and 18 in preparing yourself for adult life. There's so many things that can be done besides, you know, spending your day puttering this or that or on the telephone. If you have an interest, if you develop certain skills, if you have some identity outside of the role of mother, outside of the role of lawyer, doctor, rabbi, whatever it is that has occupied you during your so-called productive life. A terrible word. Why should life cease to be productive simply because you're not doing what you did between the ages of 25 and 65? Were you not being productive when you were in school? Can you not be productive at 70 or 75, babysitting with your grandchildren, helping out as a volunteer in some community organization, acting as a counselor in a school, offering your skills in a new way to a new generation of students? There's so many ways in which one can remain productive if one is determined to. And that's a major part of the battle. Now let me try and focus in on the Jewish attitude towards aging and the aged. And let me begin by from a non-Jewish source, which thought that it was capsuling the Jewish understanding but misunderstood our tradition completely. Robert Browning wrote, as many of you remember, about 150 years ago, a poem called Rabbi Ben Ezra. And at the very beginning of this poem, he has the rabbi say, "Grow old with me, the best is yet to be, for which the first was made." Now, it's beautiful poetry, but an absolute lie. Age is not the best of time. Whoever invented the golden age, misdirected a whole generation of the aged. Aging is a difficult time. It's a time of diminished energy. You nap. You need to take some time off during the day. It's harder to get up in the morning. It's a time when you're never very far from aches and pains, arthritis, the back. It's a time when your senses are diminished. It's harder to see. You don't hear as clearly. You don't write as boldly as you did before. It's not grow old with me, the best is yet to be, at all. Aging is a stage of life. As someone said, it's better than the alternative. But it's not the best of times. And our biblical rabbinic tradition has no illusions about aging. If you turn to the scroll of Ecclesiastes, it's a Hellenistic work written probably in the 4th, 3rd pre-Christian century, and you turn to the last chapter. You find an effusion there probably by a man who was in his mid-60s, early 70s. He'd been a member of the upper classes. He'd seen a good bit of life, and he says this by way of advice to the young. "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the time of trouble comes, before the years draw near when you will say, 'I see no purpose in them.' Remember him before the sun and the light of day give place to darkness, before the moon and the stars grow dim and the clouds return with the rain, when the guardians of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the women grinding the meal cease work because they are few, and those who look through the window look no longer. When the street doors are shut, when the noise of the mill is low, when the chirping of the sparrow grows faint, when the songbirds can no longer be heard, when men are afraid of a steep place, when the street is full of terrors, when the blossom whitens on the almond tree and the locust's paunched is swollen and caper berries have no more zest, for man goes to his everlasting home and the mourners go about the street. Remember him before the silver cord is snapped and the golden bowl is shattered, and the pitcher is shattered at the spring, and the wheel is broken at the well, before the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. There's no more heartfelt prayer in all of our Bible than a line from the 71st Psalm. Al ta'azveni be'et zikna, do not forsake me when I become old. Kichlot ruchi, al ta'azveni, when my strength weakens, do not forsake me. Do not forsake me. The Bible has no illusions about the Golden Age. It has no illusions about the losses of power, about the manipulation by the young of the aged for their own sometimes greedy purposes. It has no illusions that all families honor the aged or respect them or treat them appropriately. It has very few illusions about the inevitable wisdom of the aged in handling their relationships with their children and their grandchildren. Do you remember the story of Jacob, the patriarch who had so many sons, 12 in all? He had been a strong man. He'd been a very effective chieftain to his tribe. As a young man, he'd been very ambitious. He'd worked hard. He'd made something of himself. He'd prospered. And then when he became an older man, he was fortunate enough to have a child of his old age. And he doted on this boy more than on all of the other children put together. Here was a new relationship. He thought that there would no longer be a child, a young boy in the tent, and where the other sons were now grown and burly, and they sometimes grumbled at his leadership, and they sometimes opposed him in the council, this young boy catered to him and was soft-skinned and obviously played up to his father. And Jacob loved Joseph more than all the others, and you remember he gave him that beautiful coat of many colors. And he created such animosity towards Joseph and towards himself among his sons, his other sons, that as you remember, one day they snatched the boy, they kidnapped him, and they sold him into slavery in Egypt. And they tortured their father by telling him that a young lion had gotten hold of Joseph and torn him to pieces. And they brought in a piece of this famous coat of many colors, bloodstained, as proof of the boy's death. And for years, the old man lived on the assumption that the son whom he loved too much had in fact been killed. Now the relationship of the aged to the young is a fascinating and very complicated one. Sometimes demands are made on our children when we are aged that ought not to be made. Sometimes we show obvious preference to the one who pays least attention to us or most attention to us, and we create tensions among our children which we should not create. Our judgment is not always sound. The world closes in on us as we get older, and we often exaggerate imaginary or real petty grievances into something of consequence, and we spoil relationships which we've worked otherwise all of our lives to hold close. And do you remember the story in the Bible about Isaac, the patriarch? Isaac, again, had been a strong chieftain, a man of skill, a man of the hunt, a man of fields. But when he had grown old, like as it is with so many, his eyesight became dim, he became nearly blind, and then in a situation that does arise, I'm told, the children began to squabble over the inheritance, who would get the most money. And the biblical tradition was that the eldest son should inherit the double portion, and he was declared to be the elder by a ceremonial blessing. Well, in the harem there was a young woman, Rebecca by name, who had had a child when Isaac was already an elderly man. She'd had twins, but she preferred the youngest of the twins, Jacob. And she dressed Jacob up in the hairy skin of his brother, and she had him bring to the old man a particular delicacy that the old man doted on, some lentil soup. And they were able to cajole the old man and wheedle him into believing that Jacob was in fact Esau, and he pronounced upon Jacob a ceremonial blessing, thus investing him with the double portion and authority over the tribe. And that too is a situation that's come up again and again, I'm sure, in the history of the human race. Children ought to respect their parents. But often parents represent to their children money, inheritance, power, something that they want to get their hands on. And we are foolish and imprudent if we're not conscious that in all human relationships there is love and there is self-serving. And that's the way it is, and that's the way, if I suspect it, it always will be. And we find in the Bible the story of David, a young man, strong, a military hero, a poet, a lover, a man who was robust, filled with all of the joys of life, a man who I'm sure gave not one thought to old age, a man who came to the throne of Israel and built a great empire out of Israel. His word was the law. No one could stand before his word. And then, as is the case with all powerful people, he aged, and his strength was diminished, and ultimately it disappeared, and he became a trembling old man, cold to the touch, who had to be warmed by his courtiers in any way that they could. And ultimately, his counselors and even his sons took advantage of him, tricked him, because they wanted the power, the authority that was his. I take it that the biblical tradition emphasizes to us that in matters of age, it's not quantity, but quality. That you can live too long, that you can live in such a way that existence is a burden, that so much of what happens to us when we age depends upon the actions of those who are around us. We can't completely be responsible for ourselves, take care of ourselves, any more than we can really at any stage of life. And if the biblical tradition has any meaning for us, is that we ought to disabuse ourselves of any romantic notions about age. Age is not the best of time. Any age is a time when many of those who have catered to you all your life suddenly look right through you. You're no longer president of the corporation. You're no longer head of the bureau. You're no longer chief of medicine at the hospital. You're now just a nice old man or old woman. Notice how we categorize, we push away. We're not looking at the person, simply at their age. And those who are out for the main chance, out for themselves, now suddenly have no time, no interest in us. And those of power and those of authority, those of accomplishment in our society, find aging, retirement particularly, to be a humbling experience. One which puts pressures on their ego, which many of them are not prepared or capable of meeting. Aging is a time when many of those who thought we were so important to their lives suddenly find we are no longer important in their lives. They have no time for us. And in age, you know what has time for us? The aches and the pains and the loneliness. I heard someone say the other day, I'm just killing time. So time kills me. Now, how did the Bible handle age? The Bible is not simply interested in painting a gray dismal picture of age. The Bible was interested in establishing a social order in which there would be, at the very least, a formal respect for age. In the 28th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, there's an attempt by the author to establish the criteria of a civilized society and a barbaric society, of a society of decency and an animal-like society. And one of the major differences between the civilized community and the uncivilized community is what the Deuteronomy calls lo yisap panim lazaken. The barbaric community fails to respect age and the aged. They treat the aged as if they were non-productive and therefore useless in the social order. They cast them out. They pay no attention to them. In the families of the Middle Ages, once the father could no longer hold his own against the son, he was unceremoniously pushed out of the bedroom, the main room of the house, by the oldest son, and he and his wife had to go and live in the shed in the back, if there was in fact a shed. That's an uncivilized social order. The biblical society was patriarchal, of course. To a certain degree, it was authoritarian. But more than the system of authority within the tribe or the family structure, there was this emphasis on the formal courtesies which a young person was obligated to show to the aged. Mipnei seva takum vahadarta pnei zaken. You shall rise before the white-haired, and you shall honor the elderly. When the aged come into a room, open the door, stand up, greet them, show them the deference of their years. Look upon them not as an object to be pitied, but a person to be reverenced. You have no way of knowing the pressures, the challenges that they have met, the accomplishments which have been theirs. In the Hebrew, the word for an aged person is zaken. And it means precisely that, one who is aged, but it also means a counselor, a minister, an elder in that sense of the word. We've lost that sense in American society. We speak of the aged, not of the elderly, really. An elder had the sense of one who is consulted, one who sits in the councils of the community. Biblical society had that emphasis to it. So did the Greek social order. We use the word geriatrics today to describe the branch of medicine dealing with the problems of aging. Gerontology is the skill. The word geron in Greek has precisely the two significations of zaken in Hebrew. It means aged, the aging, and it means also one who is a minister, a counselor, whose advice is sought. There was, because of the formal courtesies which Israelite society imposed upon the young towards the elderly, there grew up this association of age and advice, age and wisdom. The aged were those who were consulted about what the society should do. Now, of course, some of this was political. In the tribe, the elder had ultimate power. He did not give over that power willingly. It could not be taken from him by force. It was his by right. But still, it shows an attempt by the society to see the aged not as objects, but as people, and to find in them some quality which was useful to and valued by the social order as a whole. Now, whenever a society tries to set up formal requirements of courtesy or respect, they're obviously going to be the young Turks who will have no part of it. And in the book of Job, we find an interesting figure, the figure of Eliu. As you know, Job is the man who proclaims his righteousness but is punished by God and made to suffer by God. And when everything has happened to Job that could possibly happen to another human, to a human being, except the fact that he's still alive, three comforters appear. Three men who try to explain to Job why all this has happened to him, to make Job say, I deserved it. And Job's unwilling to do it. And the burden of the book, the majority of the text of the book of Job, deals with the discussions between these three comforters and Job. And the discussions really are interesting and fascinating, but they get nowhere. Neither the three nor Job convinces the other. And then suddenly, towards the end of the book, another man appears, this Elihu. He's a younger man, and he has some new ideas he wants to introduce into the conversation. Now, the ideas are not as interesting as the introduction of his speech. Elihu says in the 32nd chapter of Job, I am young in years, and you three who have talked so far are old. And that is why I have held back and shrank from displaying my knowledge in front of you. I've acted the way the young are supposed to act to the old. I said to myself, let age speak, and let length of years expound wisdom. But the Spirit of God himself is in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. It is not only the old who are wise, or the aged who understand what is right. You have in the biblical tradition then a counterpoint, an argument against this automatic deference given to age, at least if that deference goes too far. And as with all virtues, there obviously has to be a middle ground, and that's what the biblical society struggled to find. The middle ground which would allow the society to show respect for the aged, but not allow the aged to dominate the social order and to frustrate its growth the way the aged dominated the social order in China over the long centuries. And so you find again in the these arguments of the young with the old. Better is a young man poor and wise than a king old and foolish. Wisdom is with the aged, and understanding is in length of days, but the ignorant, as they get older, only get more foolish. Which I think is a very well taken point. There is no automatic ennoblement to age. You don't suddenly become wise and learned and a person of discernment and great judgment, a truly civilized human being simply because you reach 65. You could be a fool at 64 and the same fool at 66. But if you've spent your life learning, growing, developing, that's another story. Then you can grow at 64, and you can grow at 65, and you can grow at 66. Now, biblical wisdom is therefore, how shall we put it? Realistic? Yes. Cynical? No. Convinced that age must be respected? Yes. Convinced that there are limits to the respect due the aged, the automatic deference? Yes. You have to earn respect, to be sure. At the same time, you must respect those who can no longer command by their quality the respect that they really once deserved. You must respect the aged even if they've lost their capacities, even if they're no longer, you know, what they were before. And in that society, there was a kind of ruthlessness, which I suspect has been part of almost every social order. But it was a ruthlessness which associated the sense of self, of worth, with what one did. There was no retirement. There were no second occupations or second professions. When you ceased to be king, you were dead, or somebody had deposed you from the throne. And then you were considered as little, except in this automatic sense. And so a good bit of the wisdom of the Bible is prudential. And it advises the elderly not to give over those attributes, those qualities, those possessions, which gain for them respect. If you're no longer king, somebody has power over you. If you're no longer chief, somebody has power over you. If no longer the mistress in your own house, somebody else is the mistress. As long as you have life and breath, never change places with anyone. It is better for your children to ask from you than for you to be dependent on them. Whatever you are doing, keep the upper hand and allow no blot on your reputation. Let your life run its full course, and then at the hour of death, distribute your estate. Prudential wisdom. But it says something about human relationships. Children love parents and they want something that their parents have. Parents love their children, but they want to assure themselves of an attention that they may not be able to command simply because they would love to have it. There is a degree of prudence which has to be exerted and exhibited in human relationships. Now, what of the rabbinic tradition? It's very much like the biblical one. The rabbis also praised age, and they also knew something of its limitations. There's a long midrash, a very lovely midrash, on the portion from Ecclesiastes that I read to you, in which every one of these phrases is equated with what happens to part of our body as we age. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, and so on. When the guardians of the house tremble, when the bones begin to rattle, when the strong men stoop, when the legs begin to bow out a little bit, when the women grinding the meal cease work because they are few, the teeth have fallen out and it's not easy to chew anymore, when the noise of the mill is low, when the chirping of the bird can hardly be heard, you don't hear as well as you used to. Each one of these phrases is associated in this rabbinic midrash with the diminution of one of our senses, the limitation of some capacity that we had before. At the same time, the rabbinic tradition continued the emphasis on the respect due the elders, the formal respect. And there's a whole body of learning which is based on the well-known commandment, one of the ten, honor your father and your mother. Kaved et avicha v'et imecha. The virtue of kibud av v'em, of respect for the parents, honoring of the parents, is the title around which almost all discussion of the relationship between the generations, the concerns of aging and the aged, is developed in the rabbinic tradition, which says something about the truth that the family was the unit through which all of these problems had to be handled. You had to be cared for by your children if you could no longer care for yourself. And they're very specific as to the care that the children owed the parent. They owed them sustenance, they owed them support, they owed them hospitality, they owed them deference. They owed them courtesy, they owed them attention, they owed them a place in their home. And all this is spelled out in the rabbinic tradition. We think of of our old age homes as relatively familiar Jewish institutions. The Moshav Zakenim sounds like an old word that comes out of the depths of the rabbinic tradition. But actually, the first old age dormitory was not created until the 1840s in the city of Frankfurt. The concept of Menorah Park of Montefiore is then hardly a century and a half old. Up to that time, the aged were taken care of by the family, or if there was no family, as was often the case, it was a mitzvah to take care of someone else's elderly. But the burden was not on the organized community as such, because the community was not organized in this way, in such a way as they could, as to be able to take advantage, as to make possible this kind of service. And if we want to know why one of the critical emotional problems which face all of us when we think of aging and of going into an institution, of being hospitalized, it comes out of our relative unfamiliarity with the Moshav Zakenim, with what an institution designed to provide for the elderly should be. We tend to think of these institutions largely as places where one goes to die. who wants to be mothballed into such a place? Surely our society could be far more creative, and in fact, in its better areas, is being far more creative in terms of the whole variety of support institutions. We now have apartment complexes where there is complete freedom for certain shared services. We now have retirement villages and retirement towns where there's a full range of recreational and social and cultural activity geared to the interests of those who are aging. The institutions of this society will ultimately provide are not simply the ultimate institution to which one goes like the elephant to his place of death in order to die. We need those too, obviously. But these institutions will be costly, and they require a great deal of imagination, and we've really only begun to think through what should be done. And moreover, many of these institutions are inadequate, and some are in fact scandalous. We have not invested any proportion of our national wealth in providing decent care, imaginative care, responsible care by the community for the aging. Now, in the rabbinic tradition, the emphasis on the respect due a parent, due the aged, was maintained. In the synagogue, the aged sat next to the ark in the place of respect. In the home, they sat at the head of the table. Insofar as it was possible to show respect for the aged, this was built into the social order. Now, obviously, not every home was virtuous. But part of the conditioning of the Jew, certainly through the centuries, was this conditioning of respect. And we can see that in the kinds of questions which were addressed to rabbis during the Middle Ages, which asked questions about how far need this respect go. After all, just as a parent two or three of the questions addressed to rabbis which have come down to us. This is a 16th century question. You have asked about a father who forbade his son to speak to a certain Jew or to pardon him until a specified date. The son wishes to become reconciled with the man, but hesitates because of his father's command. In other words, the father has an argument, a vendetta against this particular family. The son wants to make peace. The answer, know that it is forbidden to hate any Jew unless he is a sinner who violates the criminal law. The father who commands his son to hate a man does not have the right to command him to violate the words of the Torah. Furthermore, the father is thus violating the law himself and not behaving in this manner as a member of the Jewish people ought to. And in this respect, he needs not to be honored. There are things that an aging parent requires of a child, son, daughter, who are grown up, which you need not fulfill simply because the parent puts those demands on you. This question was asked of Mayor Rothenberg in the 13th century. You have asked, can a father prevent his son from going to the land of Israel, since we rule that it is a mitzvah to make aliyah? Must the son, in this respect, honor the parent's request? The response, no. In performing a mitzvah, one need not be limited to the demands of the parent. If a child, to fulfill their destiny, their sense of what they need to do professionally, needs to move to another town, the parent has no right to preclude that movement. There are limits to what a parent can demand of the child. This is from 16th century Greece. A father in the Greek town of Patras forbade his son to marry the woman whom the boy loved. Does the son's filial responsibility demand compliance? A man named Elijah Kapsali of Crete ruled that it did not, and this is his logic. Though the command of the filial honor and reverence is inexpressibly great, nevertheless it appears in my humble opinion that the girl about whom you ask is a proper wife for the aforementioned Reuben, that is, that there is in her or family no blemish, then the command of filial honor and reverence is irrelevant, and the son is not to abandon her so as to fulfill his father's command. For it is nearly certain that this father virtually commands his son to violate the Torah. For we see that the man in the Torah that a man ought not to marry a woman who does not please him.
so that when the father commands his son not to marry this woman, it is as though he commands him to violate the Torah, and it is well known that the son is not to obey his father in such cases. Again, there are limits to the deference that an adult child needs to show to the parent. Jewish life did not solve the problems of age or of aging. We have any number of evidences from our tradition of the aging who were left to suffer a bitter old age. We have any number of evidences from our tradition of bitter old people who tried to impose their bitterness, their will upon unwilling children. I don't know how you would weigh these lacks. I suppose they could be equally weighed. But this much emerges, that there is a determination in the tradition not to see the aged as people who are over the hill, out of it, objects. They are to be part of the social order. They are to be treated with respect. They are to be consulted. They are to be part of the family. They are to be supported by the family. The family is a unit of transgenerational. They are to be brought into the council of the family whenever it is possible. Can we transpose this to modern life? What emerges? First, I think the truth that aging must be looked at as a time of possibility and not of retirement, of moving into a new stage of one's life, but not necessarily a time when we've gone stale, when there's nothing more for us to do. There's an old rabbinic tradition that long life is a gift of God to the person who deserves it, that you earn long life. I'm not so sure that's true. I'm sure it's not true. But I am equally convinced that those who live a good old age, if they're fortunate enough to be healthy, whose age is a time of activity that gives pleasure to them, where they're doing things that satisfy them, are by and large people who have developed the will, sense of vitality, the interests which allow them to do something more than to vegetate. In that sense, a long life is an accomplishment which rests largely with us. It's true that the support system, which has been relied upon for the centuries of the family, is no longer adequate to the task. And that's going to require new attitudes on the part of all of us, the question of aging. We're going to have to make certain kinds of social provisions for aging. Well, a new welfare system, a new social security system, a new range of institutions. And we're only beginning to understand what's required. But we have to find some institution with which we can supplant the family and to the degree that the family cannot fulfill today's needs. We're going to have to do new research to be able to describe the process of aging, to do what we can to increase the vitality of those who are aging, to increase their ability to cope with the problems, to keep them alive physically, vitally, vigorously, insofar as we can. And above all, I suspect, we're going to have to recognize that everyone who ages and everyone who is related to somebody who is aging is a single individual. And that every relationship which involves age is a complex one which cannot be solved by any simple formula. What's right in one situation is not necessarily the appropriate answer in another situation. There are children who spend too much time with their aging parents, and there are children who spend too little time with their aging parents, and the parents are not always the best judges of that. Because I've seen parents with whom the children spend very little time, who are satisfied, and I've seen parents with whom the children spend inordinate amounts of time, sacrifice their own lives almost completely, and often their lives are their own children, and the parents are not satisfied. And the reverse is equally true. There are aging people who exercise their will and determined to make something of themselves, and there are the aged who simply crump out and want to be served and catered to and nursed and cared for and demand a service and an attention which is not good for you and besides which you'll probably not get. I've solved no problems. The Jewish tradition cannot solve problems. That's our job in the life situation. But I do know this, that the subject we've embarked on is worth a discussion, and I'd like to stop now and to have a little bit of a give and take with you on the things that have come to your mind or are uppermost in your mind in this area. Thank you. Who wants to lead off? You're not by any chance 64, are you? The question is, what do I feel about the compulsory age of retirement? It seems to me that if you accept the proposition that we're not all the same, that every one of us is an individual, any kind of compulsory age is a mistake. There are some of us who are prepared to go to college at 15, and some of us were not ready till we were 20, and some went back and for the first time when they were 50. There are some people who ought to be retired when they are 25. And there are some people who are capable of doing a full year's work and more when they're 80. I was always impressed with the man who symbolized the vigor of age was Justice Douglas, who was mountain climbing and acting as a associate justice of our Supreme Court, you know, way beyond the mandatory ages of retirement. I think you're going to find, just as a matter of course, that the pressure to for arbitrary retirement at age 65, which is really the pressure of the young against the old, I want your place, therefore I'm going to force you out. If I can't force you out of your own will, I'll force you out by some arbitrary rule, will diminish as there are more and more older people. Because in a democracy, the vote counts. And you represent today probably a third, almost, of the voting public. And the aging are could be a potent lobby if they were ever willing to, you know, draw together a set of interests. And there are beginnings in this direction, but they're only very, very rudimentary. At the same time, if we're going to live in a mass society, there are going to be some rules. Because if we're going to live in a society of computers when we're nothing but a printout, a series of, you know, holes punched into a card, business, big corporations, you know, big institutions are going to look to find easy ways to handle the personnel problems. Because how do you make, how do you tell a man who's worked for you for 40 years, you're over the hill, while the man who's on the bench next to his is allowed to continue to work? Obviously, there's a concern with favoritism. It'd be suits and countersuits, and it'd be a very serious problem. In any case, put the question another way. How many of us really ought to work doing the same thing for 50 years? Or 40 years? And should it not be a real challenge for most of us to find, you know, a second profession? Something that will freshen us up. The old routines, you know, you get very used to them, and there's very little that keeps you vigorous and energetic and eager to go to the office in the morning. There's a limit to how long you ought to do the same thing. And so, sure, you know, theoretically, I think that the arbitrary ages of retirement are, like all arbitrary rules, unfortunate. I think the idea that we all of us ought to have the idea that there's something more to life than the work that we do. And we ought to be thinking when we are 25, 35, and 45 about what we can do when we get to that stage in life. The old Jewish tradition is an interesting one. It said, never stop living. You're 87 and your wife dies, get married again. Literally, never stop living. And it's a good rule. If you set out to live, you're not going to vegetate until You know, you get to that point, you can't do anything else. But I am surrounded, as you are surrounded, by people who are vegetating, who have lived in the lap of, you know, middle class, upper middle class security, and who have spent their years, you know, really not doing much and doing less each succeeding year. Why? Because somehow they couldn't find the guts. That's what it takes. The will just to get out and do. When I go and make a call sometime after a funeral on a widow, and I'm talking now of, you know, people in their late 60s or early 70s, not beyond that too much. And I try to talk with them about, you know, doing something. Yes, Rabbi, you're right. You're right. And we talk. And generally that's the end of it. It's a little bit like the man who's had a heart attack who's going to reform. But really, you know, there's so much more to be done. There's so many ways that you can be of service if you're only willing to do it. Thus endeth my sermon for the day. Anything else? No other questions? Yes. I don't know, we're bringing in someone who is an expert on that in about 3 weeks to answer your question. The question is, are there any other apartments in Cleveland areas? And there are. But there are all kinds of things which are being experimented with, and Cleveland's often behind the times. Although we've had some very interesting sheltered housing built next to the Jewish Community Center, we've had things of that kind. And I remember reading not so long ago, you may have seen it in the New York Times Magazine, about a commune of the elderly in Chicago run by the Jewish Community Federation of Chicago. Fascinating idea. They took over an old apartment complex and they provided, you know, a small and dispensary and infirmary and communal kitchen, knocked out walls. And the people who are there have organized themselves as a commune and they do everything themselves. One does the shopping and one does the cooking. And one provides, you know, the cultural entertainment for the day. And there's it's like a kibbutz. You know, there's a system of sharing out the work. And one of the things that they discover is that once, as you would know from common sense, if you feel part of what's happening to you, you'll concern yourself with it. If it's simply being done for you, you sit back and you complain. And the interesting, these people are, apparently, I've never been in the place, are excited by it, and they have a very satisfying life, you know, in this area. There's so many things that can be done, but it takes money, it takes time, it takes some professional guidance, it takes a concern by the society in making provisions, which our society has not yet evidenced its willingness to do. Most nursing homes and most old age homes exist on the fringes of the social order. They're run by business people for profit. That's the motive, not the motive of social service. There was a terrible scandal the last couple of years in New York City, which involved some of the pillars of the Orthodox Jewish community in New York City, where they had been milking the elderly of Medicare and Medicaid and the other, you know, welfare provisions, and not providing them the minimal amounts of services. And until we get as concerned with aging as we are concerned with youth and invest the same kind of effort, we're not going to really begin to provide the services, the institutions which need to be provided. Jerry?
One of the things you suggested, Rabbi, is the need for greater selectivity as far as the aging and treatment in terms of compulsory retirement or whatever opportunities and treatments are appropriate. As society becomes more aware both ways.
in life, all things go both ways. But what the elderly get in our society is so minimal that it's tragic. You know, we live in a society which has institutionalized inflation. And the aging are the people who worked during the years of the hard dollar. And sure, there's a small percentage of them at the top who have put away, you know, sufficient money. But that percentage is tiny compared to the total need. And every year, the money buys less and less. And so more and more of them, you know, have to make do with age of the aged or public welfare plus the Social Security, which is minimal. And if you've looked at what catastrophic illness can cost, you know, those checks of $300, $400, $500 a month, you know, hardly begin to cover. And there are all kinds of needs that have to be helped with. Nutritional needs, budgeting needs, needs to provide the basic utilities. Think of it, the great state of Ohio just yesterday passed a bill, the governor signed a bill so that the elderly who are in need can get reduced rates for heat for another cold winter, which says what? The last winter they didn't have the money to have heat, and some of their heat was turned off. The elderly are really the other America today, and it's a growing number. And it's a number which is not limited to, blacks and Chicanos. It's, you want to see the elderly, poor elderly, you can find them among Jews in every community. People on food stamps, people who are struggling to make ends meet, who need to have food brought in. Think of the terror of living by yourself and suddenly finding that you don't have the strength, the ability, or the money to go out and buy the little food that you need. You know, that happens, people live in that condition every day of their lives. So I don't worry too much about the trade-offs. I think we've got to make a quantum jump in terms of basic supports and basic services and necessary institutions. And the cost is gonna be astronomical. You know, make no mistake about it, you and I, the people, you know, who are working now are going to pay a very high tariff for these services. We can talk easily about them, but they're going to come dear. They've got to come. And interestingly, they haven't come despite the fact that every one of us knows that someday we're going to need them. That's the thing that's most interesting to me. We all want to live long. We all assume that we're the ones who are going to live long. You know, somebody else is going to be the actuarial statistic. And yet we do almost nothing to provide the services which we may in fact need to see that they are legislated into the social order. Now, Freud could explain that perhaps. But I find it very difficult in terms of a society of reasonable men and women. Well, the question is, the statement was Sweden provides very well for their elderly. How do they do it? They do it with a high rate of taxation and a low rate of defense spending. They do it by because they have a relatively small homogeneous social order where somehow taxes are not what you spend for somebody else, but they recognize as what you spend for yourself. That's one of the problems in America. We assume that if we have to tax ourselves for new institutions, it's going to be for somebody else's benefit. But in Sweden and in Denmark and in these other Scandinavian countries, the society, there's no group you don't like out there of any size, at least none in the social order. In Sweden, the Algerian workers who are there and the Yugoslav workers, they get none of the social benefits, so they don't worry about them. They're not citizens. As far as citizens are concerned, you're going to get the advantage ultimately. We don't have that feeling, so we don't vote the taxes. It's not popular to talk of higher expenses, so none of the politicians talk about it. When's the last time you heard a politician talk seriously about the building adequate facilities, providing adequate services for the aging? It's just not politic as yet. Jason? Well, we've done that. You know that the CMHA projects have had some intermingling of families and the aged for 20 years here in Cleveland. Israel has one interesting phenomenon, and that's if you examine the kibbutz. Because the kibbutz takes away all the economic consequences of age, because everybody is provided for. There's none of these problems. But the problem of age remains, and the kibbutz has not known how to handle it. Because everything is determined in terms of your usefulness to the social group. And since the basic philosophy which went in was one of agriculture, physical labor, all the things that the aged increasingly cannot do, many of the kibbutzim have not been able to make the idealistic or ideological transformation to value the things which come from here and here and patience and love and sensitivity and not from, you know, brute physical force. We've got to get beyond, you know, the kind of mechanistic, materialistic evaluation of people as human resources for the social benefit. That was Hitler's way. There was a simple problem to solve, the problem of the aging. You go into the old folks' homes, you take them all out, you put them in a train, and you gas them. Or you inject them while they're still in the home with some kind of lethal poison. Why? Because Plato had said long before that the aged are useless to the society. They've outlived their function. And many social groups, you know, have put them on the ice floe and let them sail off into the great beyond. But if we're going to talk about the sacredness of human life and the possibilities of human life, with everything I think our Jewish tradition stands for, we can't go that way. And that means a complete transvaluation of values as far as people as people, as a set of people as objects are concerned. And that's the way I think we have to go. One more question, then we're going to stop. Obviously, but one thing, Leslie, you ought to remember is that no social experiment is ever successful, by definition. We simply don't know how to cultivate the arts of living easily together. And yes, there are problems of class and problems of place, and what may work in, you know, one middle-class environment may not work in one street environment or inner-city environment. But at the same time, there are no panaceas. There's no way which guarantees that a mixing of age groups or a homogeneous age group or something of this type is desirable. If you go to some of the old folks' homes, you'll find terrible battles going on between people in adjoining beds or people in adjoining rooms or people on different floors. And they all come out of the same social environment, you know, and they may have played bridge with each other for 50 years before they got into this situation, but now it's a different, you know, kind of ball game. People are simply, we're not socialized as yet very effectively. And the fact that we can tell some horror stories about one experiment or another does not preclude the possible advantages which comes in a different setting to the same experiment. Well, thank you very much, and I hope you'll enjoy our series.